Isaiah chapter 1 this morning. We walked through the whole book together last week, and we'll look just a little bit at that outline once again, because it really does matter that we know where we are in this book. So we'll revisit it just a little bit, as we've done with the book of Romans, just to help us find our place in the book of Isaiah. But Isaiah chapter 1, we're going to just deal with 9 verses this morning. That should be a chewable portion for us. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Children have I reared and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. Why will you be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick, the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They are not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, foreigners devour your land. It is desolate, as overthrown by foreigners. And the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we should have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. This is a vision, the vision of Isaiah, which he saw. And what we're looking at as we look at the book of Isaiah is the fact that there are different ways of seeing. In fact, perspective matters, does it not? It's the same thing lying between the two men, but depending on which side you're staring at it, you see something different. Same thing can be with a letter as it is with a number. But perspective matters. And as Isaiah is presenting a view to Israel of Israel, he does so from the perspective of God. He actually gets outside planet Earth and he gives us a divine perspective on who we are as a people. But it's not a perspective that we would come up with on our own. It's not a perspective that we would embrace willingly by ourselves. There's not a lot of us who thump our chests and say, woe is me, I am undone, I am a sinful man. And yet that is where Isaiah's vision begins. We're not told his calling just yet, because as any book does, not every single book, but there's kind of an introduction. And this is Isaiah's introduction. He kind of gives an overview of where this is going. And for the first 5 chapters, we're kind of given the prologue to the book of Isaiah, probably written after the rest of the book has been compiled. The book of Isaiah, he says, these were given to him, this vision, this revelation was given to him in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, and all of these reigned for years. So these are different messages that he gave at different times over the course of some 40 plus years in ministry, and he wrote them down. And it seems that at the end of compiling these, now he puts together the introduction. He gives us kind of a sweeping overview of where this book is going. And so He's kind of starting in the middle or stating the condition of why these messages have to be proclaimed. But as he is giving to us this vision, this perspective from God on his people, what we're going to see in this first chapter is that God is working his sovereign will in the sacred realms of secular time and space. God, who is holy, in fact, I forget if it's 35 times in the book of Isaiah, he uses the title the Holy One of Israel. It's a unique title. It's mostly used by Isaiah. Only 6 other times in the Old Testament is it used. But the Holy One of Israel, he's going to hold out in front of the people. And he's going to say, listen, this Holy One of Israel is also the King of the universe. He's the King of all creation. And that's why he's going to say in verse 2 of chapter 1, I'm calling the heavens and earth to bear witness, to hear the word of the sovereign God, because the Lord has spoken. Verse 4, they've despised the Holy One of Israel, who is, verse 9, the Lord of hosts. The hosts of heaven, the hosts of earth, all bow to the sovereignty of this holy God. That means there is no such thing as secular time or secular space. If God is in charge of it all becomes sacred because he is holy. And he is holy and he is sovereign. And he is interjecting his goodwill on planet Earth even when bad things happen, even when bad people are working at their worst. That's where Isaiah is stepping in. And he's confronting a people who are working against God to their own detriment. And God at the same time is intervening to work for the benefit of those who are rebelling against him. What an amazing God. In fact, we just got done with the book of Romans, and we find that there is not one righteous, not even one. And as the world, as a cumulative, as a corporate entity, is working against God, God is single-handedly working for humanity. What an amazing gospel. As we drill down on this, we need to keep in mind where this book is going and what this book looks like. And so there's going to be several different times that we're going to revisit some of the same different patterns, some of the same different themes. But Isaiah is going to be developing a message. He's not going in circles, and he's not allowing them to go in circles. What he's doing is he's drilling down on the fact that they're actually spiraling downward as they continue this path of rejection, of this path of forsaking God, of this path of enjoying his gifts while forgetting the giver. And so there's going to be some repetition that happens in the book of Isaiah. That's on purpose. Because just like in the book of Judges, they're going to fail deeper and deeper and deeper. As Isaiah is going to develop, he's going to give us different visions at different times. He's going to see part of something in the future. And he'll see a peak that's off in the distance. And it's going to sound like it's at a nearer peak. And we're not going to see that there's different chasms and valleys that lie between the peaks of his visions. And so it kind of gets all smashed into a two-dimensional vision because we don't have the perspective that God has looking down on time and space. And so at times, this is a confusing book because we're only given the mountain peaks of this prophecy. And so we come to chapter 9 and or maybe chapter 7, and we see the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. Not knowing that it's going to be over 700 years until Jesus Christ is conceived of a virgin. and God comes to dwell with man. We don't understand that God is going to disperse his people upon planet Earth, the Jews. He's going to send them out into exile. And it's not going to be till after Jesus Christ builds his church that finally he's going to draw Jews from every sector of creation back to the promised land, back to their king. These are things that are hinted at, but they're not understood solely by an Isaianic perspective. So they're kind of smashed into one. We've talked a little bit at length the fact that Isaiah is sometimes called the fifth gospel, the gospel of the Old Testament. He is, other than Deuteronomy, the theology book of the Old Testament. And he uniquely points to Jesus Christ repeatedly. Chapter 53, we still go to on Good Friday. Why? Because he has borne our sins. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And by his stripes, we are healed, right? So, I mean, everything that happened on Good Friday is forecast for us in Isaiah 53. What an amazing thing. This book points us to Jesus in a way that no other Old Testament book does. We've seen that it was written about the time of Homer's Iliad, that he ministers in the southern kingdom of Judah. Israel, after Solomon, splits into two kingdoms. Israel, 10 tribes to the north. Judah stays to the south. And it's Judah that has Jerusalem as its capital. It's Judah that has the Davidic line as its king. And so Isaiah ministers to the southern kingdom in Judah with Jerusalem as its capital, with a Davidic king as its king. He's the introduction to all the prophets. There's only two that precede him of the writing prophets. And God had told Moses that there's coming a prophet. There's coming a prophet. So there were prophets that were operative in Israel, not all writing prophets, but Isaiah becomes one of the major and the primary initiatory writing prophet in the Old Testament. And we see that what he does as he begins this prophecy is he quotes from the book of Deuteronomy. We looked at it in Moses' song as he begins in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. What God was doing, he was laying out a covenant agreement with his people, and he was calling the heavens and earth to bear witness that Israel was going to break covenant with God. At this point, at this moment in history, Isaiah shows up on the scene and says, 800 years ago when we came into this land, God gave us this song, and now he wants us to remember it because this was the time he was talking about. So this is what he picks up on, and this is what he begins with. The name of Isaiah means Yahweh is salvation. So as he's bringing a message of God's judgment, that's only part of his message. His name itself means God is salvation. Salvation from what? Salvation from God's judgment. Okay, that's what we have to be saved from. Do you understand that God saves you from two things? He saves you from you and your propensity towards sin, your propensity to self-destruction, and he saves you from him. God's absolute holiness is something that's too terrifying even to describe or imagine. You are not fit for God's presence in your current condition. There would be a nuclear meltdown if you were to have access to the Holy God. In fact, even the priests, if they did not follow exactly the requirements of God, took their own lives in danger as they entered in behind the veil, because God at any moment could strike them dead by his holiness because of the defilement of their sin. God saves us from ourselves, and God saves us from himself. That's the beauty of God's salvation. He has two sons whose names are both positive and negative. The first one means a remnant shall return. Well, a remnant from what? A remnant from the spoils, or a remnant from the destruction that is swiftly coming. So we have swiftly coming destruction, but a remnant that remains or returns. So these, it doesn't sound like a wonderful message, right? God's judgment is speedy and it's big. But God's grace is real and it's sufficient. And this is what it means that God is salvation. Not everyone will be saved. In fact, not most. It's just a few that understand, that God gives understanding to, that humble their hearts before this holy God and say, I am the sinner deserving of hell. You are the God whose grace is sufficient. We've seen that he's writing to Israel in the context of these kings, but when he's called in chapter 6, it's really God's kingship that's at stake. It's God's sovereignty that is being revealed in the midst of all of this outworkings in Israel. We see that he's called in the context of God's holiness. He says that he was called into the palace, the throne room of God, which is the temple, and that God is seated on a throne high and lifted up. His robe, the train of his robe, fills the whole temple. There's angels crying, holy, holy, holy. And as he gets this vision of God's holiness, he has a keen sense of awareness of his sinfulness. And he says, woe is me, I am undone. An angel comes and takes tongs and takes a coal off the altar and brings it to his lips. And he touches his lips and says, now you have been made clean. It's not just because there's coals in heaven that make things clean. It's that there's an altar in heaven where the blood of Jesus Christ would one day be offered for the sacrifice and the substitution of all sinners. And that altar is the source of the cleansing of God's prophet. And we see that he's called in the context of Israel's failure. God's sovereignty, God's holiness, Israel's failure. What a combination, right? But that's why this prophet is needed. Because God is holy and his people aren't. And there has to be some mediator between God and man. Jesus isn't yet present. The prophet at this moment is on the scene to stand as mediator between holy God and sinful people. That's the purpose. That's the function of Isaiah. The outline, very quickly, chapters 1 through 39, or we could take it up through 1 through 35. But there's an old covenant lawsuit. We looked at the stipulations of it, Deuteronomy 32. If you obey, you'll be blessed. If you disobey, you'll be cursed. They disobey, they're cursed. And there's going to be a destruction of the old covenant kingdom. From the time that Babylon comes, there is going to be no more Davidic king on the throne. It's done. It's just done. Israel as a nation is only going to be under other rulers, whether it's Persia or Greece or Rome. They'll exist, but they'll never be independent. We see then in chapters 40 through 55 that a new covenant leader will emerge, that he will be Davidic in nature, that he will be a servant of God's people, and he will be a substitute for God's people. He will be the true Israel. He will be the true vine, an image that's given to us in Isaiah chapter 5. Jesus picks up on that in John chapter 15. I am the true vine, the one that Israel failed to be. And then we see in chapters 56 through 66 that God is preparing a new covenant dwelling. There's going to be a new capital for God's people with a new king seated on the throne. That place will be called Zion, the city of God, and it stands in juxtaposition, Hebrews chapter 12, to Mount Sinai, that mountain of God where the shaking terror and holiness of God threatens his people. Mount Zion becomes a city of rejoicing, a city of feasting, a city of pleasure, a city of peace. Salem, Shalom. What a beautiful story, right? That's the structure. But as we look at the central character of this book, we see in chapters 1 through 35 that there must be a righteous king to administrate God's peace. We see in chapters 40 through 55 that there must be a righteous servant who takes our place. And in chapters 56 through 66, there must be a righteous messenger who brings God's Spirit and Word. We need one who will be our king. We need one who will be our priest. We need one who will be our prophet. And Jesus is the one that this book anticipates. At the center of this book, chapters 36 through 39, we're given a story that really gives us the central question of the prophet Isaiah. What will you do? In whom will you trust? We're given a short story of one of the most magnificent kings in Israel's history, Hezekiah. He's a good king. And for the most part, he follows God. He follows God through a difficult time, a difficult test. Half of the test, he passes. Half of the test, he fails. And we're left with this question right in the middle of the book. If somebody like Hezekiah can fail, what hope is there for us? Praise God, there's Jesus. There's coming a king who will not fail. So that's the feel, that's the overflow, that's the overview of the book. Very quickly this morning, I want us to see that as God is working his sovereign will in the sacred realms of this secular time and space, that God speaks into the unvarnished story of his people. Verse 1, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. It's described as a vision. It doesn't necessarily give to us a lot of visual aspect to it, and that's really not the point. The idea is that he sees something beyond what is seeable. He is a prophet. He is a seer. Seer. That's what we get that word seer from. He sees something beyond the visible realm. So this is a divine revelation that he didn't rise to, he's brought into. God reaches down and lifts him up to see things that other people can't, but only because God reached down to give it to him. But I want us to note in this first verse that God is always operative within this world. This is God's world. It's a world of God's making. It operates by God's rules. And when we work against God's rules, it's only because he allows us to do so for a certain time, to a certain extent. God is always operating within his world, and part of his operation is giving his message to his servant to give to his people. And so God gives his servant this message, and this message is a sovereign word from God. God the Lord who has spoken, verse 2. God who is the Holy One of Israel. He's spoken in the past. He's speaking again. God, verse 9, who is the Lord of hosts. The one who spoke and the heavens came into existence. The one who spoke and filled dry land and sea. He spoke. And his speaking is an active participation inside his creation. You realize that every time we come together on a Sunday, every time a church assembles on a Sunday, and God's word is spoken, God is taking an active role within his creation. Isaiah 55, verse 10. He says, my word will not go out unless I give it to accomplish its purpose, and it will. God says, every time my word is spoken, I send it out to do my work, even in this fallen world. And God is operating even today. This is the vision that he's given. And he saw this vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem. So not only is it a sovereign word, but there's a sovereign realm. He's giving this to a covenant people, people of the Abrahamic covenant, people of the Mosaic covenant. He's their covenant God. He's Yahweh who speaks. He has a name, a personal name. He stands in contrast to the Baals. He stands in contrast to Re and some of the other Egyptian gods. He has a name. His name is Yahweh. And when Moses brings this name to Pharaoh, he says, who is Yahweh that I should obey him? Thank you for asking. Let me introduce you to Yahweh. Boom, 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 boom. 10 plagues. Oh, that Yahweh. Okay. They're a covenant people whose God is Yahweh, the living God. To be. He is. I am. Okay. So this is written to Judah. It's a covenant people. It's written about Jerusalem. Jerusalem, its other name is Zion. It speaks of the royal city, the city of David. It speaks of the city, the sacred city, that place where God chose to place his name, Deuteronomy 12. It's the place where a temple would be built for his glory, the glory of his name, the sacred city, Zion, where God's king and God's palace are on planet Earth. He calls it his footstool because it's the place where God's foot touches down between heaven and earth. God is connected to this planet through the place of Jerusalem. What an amazing place. So when Isaiah says, listen, God has given to me a vision about this covenant people in this covenant place, it's the place where God has chosen to intersect with heaven and earth. Okay, he has our attention from verse 1. But not only is there a sovereign word, a sovereign realm, there's a sovereign role that this city plays in all of God's economy. He says, I'm writing about Judah and Jerusalem, and I'm writing in regard to the kings who dwell there. Kings. Kings of God's city. They're anointed representatives of God himself on planet Earth. They're not just kings like other nations have kings or presidents or ambassadors or whatever you want to put it there. Prime ministers. This is the king of God's people in God's promised land at the head of God's creation. This guy has a role that nobody else on planet Earth has. He's an anointed one. He's a Messiah is the name for the anointed one who represents God. And so these men function as small m messiahs. They're anointed ones. They're kingly representatives of the King of Heaven. And the whole point is that each of them is a failure. And God will send one who will not fail. But not only is there a sovereign word, a sovereign realm, a sovereign role, but there's a sovereign time. He says he's writing these, he sees these in the days of these specific kings. Uzziah. When we hear the word Uzziah, we don't think a lot about Uzziah. We're like, oh, well, there's a name for you. Fuzzy belly button. What are we talking about? Uzziah. Uzziah. What is Uzziah? Uzziah is a name that would be known. Uzziah was one of the longest reigning kings. The only longer reigning king in Israel was Manasseh, who comes after Hezekiah. But Uzziah was one of those guys who reigned over Israel. He did what was right. He did what was good. God gave him success. God gave him wisdom, God gave him wealth, God gave him glory, and God gave him peace. And so for some 51 years, he's reigning, and he's a good king. And it seems like Israel, God's people, is going the right direction. And then this king gets a little bit cocky and full of himself, and he decides king isn't enough. He wants to be priest. And so he takes a censer and puts some special things in there to bring the aroma, the incense in before God. And he walks into the temple as a priest. King, whoa, that wasn't his to do. 80 men rush into the temple, all priests. They grab him and say, King, you can't do this. And he gets mad. Who are you to tell me I can't do this? Throws him off. I'm the king. And as soon as he says that, boom, leprosy starts filling his forehead. And they look at Uzziah and they say, King, you got to get out. You are unclean. You've stepped into the role of the holy God, the realm of the holy God. And God in his holiness has discovered your unholiness. And he's put a visible mark on you that you are unclean. And though you are rightfully the anointed one of God, you never, ever, ever will be allowed in this city of God's presence again. And he goes out and he spends the rest of his days outside the city where he was king. Whew. That's when Isaiah came on the scene. His son Jotham becomes king for 16 years. And it's during Jotham's reign that Syria comes in league with Ephraim, the northern tribes, and they make a coalition and they start to harass Judah. They're bigger, they're more in number, and they come into power during the realm of Joseph, and then during the reign of Ahaz, they become a threat. And two different times, once 120,000, the next time 200,000 of his people are removed because Ahaz decides rather than to trust in God, chapter 8, chapter 7 of Isaiah, rather than trust in God, I'm going to trust in chariots and horses. I'm going to make a league with Assyria. We're so bad at history and we're so bad at geography. Syria, Assyria, same thing, right? What kind of cereal are we talking about? Does it need milk? Syria is a small kingdom up by Ephraim, or northern kingdom of Israel. Assyria is a little farther north, just to the other side of Babylon, which sits over here. Assyria, Syria, Israel, Jerusalem. Ahaz says, listen, Assyria is bigger than Syria. I'm going to ask them for help. Great idea, until it's not. And all of a sudden, Assyria becomes bigger than Syria, and that which was a friend to Ahaz now becomes the threat that wipes him out in 722 BC and comes down, breathing down the neck of the next king, Hezekiah, and destroys everything in the place except Jerusalem. This is the time when Isaiah is ministering. So Hezekiah throws himself on his knees before God. We read this story in chapters 36 and 37. He throws himself on his knees before God and says, God, would you please get us out of this fix? I trust in you. I can do nothing as your king, but you can do everything as the king. And God says, very good, Hezekiah. I'll do it. And he wipes out 185,000 in a night. Whoosh, gone. The enemy's destroyed. Because God's king. And then he gets sick. He says, oh God, please don't take my life. And he gets better. He says, oh God, thank you for saving my life. And the king of Babylon sends him congratulations. And he says, hey, while you guys are here, let me show you how great I am. Come and look at all my treasures. Come and look at all my weapons. Come and look at all my wealth. Come and look at, come and, Let me impress you. Let's be in league together. Let's build a pact. Let's be friends. God says, I think I've seen this before. Didn't Ahaz want to be friends with the enemy? Hezekiah, you really want to trust in other kings rather than in me? Okay, chapter 39. Let me tell you what's going to happen for you, Hezekiah. Your sons are going to be taken into captivity. You will go to Babylon, and that will be your judgment. And he says, shwew, at least it's not me, it's just my kids. What a schmuck, right? This is the unvarnished story where God says, listen, their sin is not derailing my plan. I'm still at work. I'm still going to gain glory. I'm still going to win. My good purposes will be accomplished because I am in charge, period. Full stop. That's the beginning of this message. With all of these fallen kings, with all of these failed messiahs, God is speaking of a Messiah who will not fail. Number two, God invokes the covenant that he makes with his people. This is the vision, and it begins. Hear, O heavens, give ear, O earth, for Yahweh has spoken. Oh, that has everybody's attention. He's grabbed us by the lapels, like mine was up earlier. All right, he's got our lapel. Boom, he's grabbed us. He's got our attention. God has spoken. Remember last time he spoke? I mean, to them as a whole people, up on the mountain, and as he's speaking, there's tremblings and there's trumpets and there's clouds and there's darkness. And they said, Moses, you go up and talk to him. He's bigger than we can handle. And Moses goes up into the thick darkness where God is. But as God speaks now, we see not only that he operates within his world, but he always operates according to his word. How do we know what God's going to do? Well, he's told us. And he goes back to his covenant that he made with Israel way back in the book of Deuteronomy. And he recites from Deuteronomy 32. And he picks up where he left off. He says, listen, I'm invoking the witnesses of heaven and earth. We've talked about this in the past. That if you fail, I will judge. And that's happening at this moment. He says, middle of verse 2, children I have reared and brought up, but they've rebelled against me. He uses this covenant terminology when God meets with Moses on the mount, getting ready to bring God's people out from Egypt. He says, I want you to tell Pharaoh this. Israel is my firstborn son. This whole people, I'm treating as my son, my firstborn son. Let my son go that he can come and serve me, not as a slave, but as a son. He can enter into my ways. He can enter into my peace. He said, I know that Pharaoh is going to tell you no, so I want you to warn him from the very beginning. If you do not let my firstborn son go, I will take your firstborn son. Plague number one, blood, forecast. Plague number two, the stench of frogs. All of these different plagues are on different gods in Egypt. And God is going to take out the sun, darkness that they can feel. Egypt has the sun god. It's their primary god. And for 3 days, they're living in the light of a blind god. Whew. Amazing witness to this powerful God who is. They get done after 9 plagues, and plague number 10, God says, okay, Pharaoh, I warned you. You will not let my son go, so I will take your son. And that's where we have the Passover. The lamb is slain, and all the firstborn sons of Israel are free. But Pharaoh's firstborn son is slain. God says, listen, I've taken to myself sons. I've redeemed their lives. I've purchased their lives. By blood, I've passed over them in judgment. Not only did I raised them as children, but I've provided for them then in the desert. I've guided them. I gave them water where there was no water. I gave them food where there was no food. I have not only called them out, but sustained them along the way. Now answer me this, he says in verse 3. Why is it that an ox can know its owner? Why is it that a donkey can know its master, but Israel, my people, don't have as much understanding as a donkey or an ox? How does that make sense? My people are a non-understanding people. And he uses again the language of Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 28. They have no understanding. They're like animals. In fact, they're less intelligent than animals. Verse 4. He lets out this, oi, oi. It's the word that's sometimes translated woe, sometimes has the meaning of damned. It also sometimes carries the idea of this is too much. And God gives this wail, oh, my people. And it's not this angry wail, oh, my people. It's this burdened wail. It's like, how could you? It's when a wife finds out that her husband ran off with another woman. It's like, how could you do that? He says, my people don't understand. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who dealt corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. It was them. How could they do this to me? That's the feel that God pours into this as he's condemning these people. How does he see his people? He sees them in light of the covenant terms that he established with them back in Egypt, back at Sinai. He says, they're my people, Exodus 6, verses 6 and 7. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. It's with this ring I thee wed. You're mine. I'm yours. My people. And he says, not only are they my children, they're my people, and they're my nation. But they're, I said in Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6, I'm going to take them to be a holy nation. They're going to be my segola. They're going to be my top drawer special possession. You have a junk drawer? You keep all your special stuff in? Okay. He says, This is my treasure chamber, and Israel's in my top drawer. I'm not getting rid of them. And if everything else goes up in flames, I'm grabbing the top drawer and taking it with me, right? He says, that's how they belong to me, because they're a holy nation. They're special. They're precious. My precious. This is my precious, okay? He says, you know what happened to my precious? The holy nation becomes a sinful nation. He says they are laden with iniquity. The idea is that they are heavy. They have become a burden. Down, I think it's in chapter verse 14 of this. He says, I'm weary. I'm tired. I'm worn out of dragging the dead weight of my people. They are laden down with their iniquities. He says they're offspring, but they're not offspring as in promised seed offspring, as in the promised seed of the woman, standing in distinction to the seed of the serpent. They're no longer seed of Abraham, who's going to train his children to walk in the ways of the Lord. They're the seed of the enemy. They're the seed of the evildoers. They're the seed of the wrongdoers rather than the seed of the right doers. This is what my covenant people have become. They are children who deal treacherously, corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. The idea isn't like they lost him. Where'd we put God? It's like, this is God? Let's cordon him off. Let's keep God in a God box. And let's do our life the way we want to over here, as far away from God as we can. Let's get him out of schools. Let's get him out of the public realm. Let's get him out of government. Let's get him out of everything. Get him out of life. We want nothing to do with God. We're forsaking him. We're walking away from him. We deliberately want to do life apart from him. It's when the spouse hands the divorce papers and says, "We're finished. I want to see you never again. If I ever see you again, it's too early." That's what they're saying to God. They've despised the Holy One of Israel. The Holy One of Israel. What makes Israel different from every other nation on the planet? They have a God who's real, and he has spoken. And he's interjected his power, his presence, his provision on planet Earth. He's real, and everybody knows it. When he's manifested his goodness for his people, other people tremble. And they said, "Yeah, we can do life without this God." That's a head scratcher. And God presents it as such. They've despised the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. The Hebrew here is a little different. It says, they have turned backward unto estrangement. They've gone from being children to going back to a position of being foreigners. They're strangers to this God. They have nothing to do with me because of their own desire. Verse 5, he asks a question, why would you be struck down? Why would you continue in this rebellious state? Your head is sick. Your heart is faint. It's interesting what sin does to us. And this is where this chapter becomes so revelatory for us today. Because this is what sin does to us as a people. It takes your head and it makes you sick in the head. See, why would a guy walk out on his wife and his kids in order to chase down somebody he doesn't even know? That doesn't make sense. You're right. But you know what? That's exactly what sin does. Sin promises us something that it can never deliver on, and it makes us throw away that which we hold, and it's good. It doesn't make sense. It makes you sick in the head. It also makes you faint in the heart. And we weary ourselves as we chase down that which sin promises. There's going to be two things in this chapter he's going to develop. You're going to chase after bribes and you're going to chase after sex. The money and sex, okay? Not a lot has changed in thousands of years. Okay? These were the things that lured people away from God in the past. These are the things that lure people away from God in the present. Money and sex. He says, when that becomes your God, it proves that your head is sick and your heart is small. If that's what you're living life for, you are such a small person. Now, how many of us want to say, I want to give my life to money and sex? You wouldn't say it out loud, but how many of us have ever struggled with those two arenas in life? Right? Right? If we don't get good at confession as the people of God, we'll not see others join us in confession. We have to get good at saying, you know what? I am the sinner. I am undone. And there, but for the grace of God, that's me. Okay. This is my head that's weak. This is my heart that's small. And if I'm only holding on to God's blessings, I'm letting go of God. I'm forgetting God. I can't afford that. And so he says, why would you continue down this road? Verse 6, from the sole of your foot even to your head, there's no soundness, there's no health. You have bruises and sores and wounds because of my chastisement. I keep trying to prod you into the way. But it's not because I'm poking you, it's because you're running into my stick. You keep beating your head against the wall. He said, I do bruise, but I do bind up. I do inflict the cause of your pain, but I also am the source of your healing. That's what I want to do. But if you cordon me off, if you throw me away, there's nothing to fix the wound that you've gotten yourself into. So God says, listen, I've told you. If you abandon me, you abandon your life. If you chase other gods, you chase down your death. Finally, God highlights his steadfast love for his people. Verse 7, look around you. Again, this is probably written at the end of Isaiah's ministry as he puts this whole book together. He says, look around you. Your country lies desolate. It has to be at a time when his country dies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, there are foreigners who now eat up your land. My good provision isn't going to your storehouses, it's going to their pantries. Your country is desolate. It's overthrown by a foreign people. This word overthrown is used 7 times in the Old Testament. This is the only time it's used of Israel. The other 6 times it's used of the city of Sodom. Overthrown. Your city has become a Sodom. That sinful nation, that wicked people, that perversion against God. Yeah, that's what you've become. And the daughter of Zion, that tender, precious daughter. Guys, if you have daughters, you know there's a difference between daughters and sons, right? Sons, you kind of whap them upside the head, kind of join arms, bring them out. Yeah. We do stuff together. Daughters, you never whap them upside the head. Right? You tenderly care for a daughter. God says, you know how I see my people? Zion, she's my daughter. Jerusalem is my daughter. Jerusalem, the place of my palace, the place of my king, the place of my anointed one, my representative, my people's representative. This is a special place. The daughter of Zion is like a booth in a vineyard, a lodge in a cucumber field. She's like a besieged city. This is probably talking about what happened in chapters 36 and 37, where Assyria comes down, sweeps through Israel, comes down to Judah, and takes everything but the capital city. Hezekiah says, God, help us. And he does. And the only thing that's left standing is Jerusalem. The only thing that's left standing is Jerusalem. He says, look at the cucumber field. It's all plucked, and there's one little shabby hut right in the middle. That's Jerusalem in the middle of desolation. It's worthless. It's weak, and now it's threatened. Verse 9, if the Lord of hosts had not left us just a few survivors, we would have been like Sodom. We would have been like Gomorrah, because we deserve God's judgment. Have you ever come to the place in your life where you say, you know what? My head is sick. My heart is weak. I'm the sinful one who deserves God's judgment. That's the beginning of the gospel message. What the gospel message does is it holds up a mirror to us and it says, listen, God is holy and you are not. Would you admit that? Would you be willing to say, I'm a sinner. God, forgive me. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Or will you be like the Pharisee? God, thank you that I'm not like those guys over there, that publican. Thank you that I'm a better man than that. God says, there's no hope for you if that's what you're thinking. The only hope for you is if you can see, God, I'm the sinner. I'm not even worthy to look up to you, but please be merciful to me, a sinner. And God says, when that's your heart, he'll show his mercy. Because you deserve the same judgment that Sodom and Gomorrah got. But I want you to tell you something. God always operates, not just according to his word. He always operates according to his ways. And he's a merciful God. He's a compassionate God. He's a delivering God. And he will send an anointed one to stand in your place, to deliver you from you. And to deliver you from me. Chapter 1. What a beautiful start. Such a beautiful gospel. But God is working. And he's working his sovereign will. And he's working it in the sacred realms of what we call secular time and secular space. But my friend, there is no such thing as a secular time and space in your life or anybody else's, because it all belongs to God. The question is, how do you see yourself in God's sacred economy? Do you see Him? Do you see yourself as one of His champions? You're here to fix the world for God. Or do you see yourself as one who is desperately in need of His grace? If you see yourself as desperately in need of His grace, there's hope for you. If you don't, I can offer you no hope. He's working His sovereign will, and His sovereign will is good. And it's good because He's a good God. And that's what we celebrate as we come to this table this morning. We do have a King who did suffer in our place, who did lay down His life to save you from you and to save us from Him. Let's pray.